It's time for us to begin. If you would please open your Bibles to Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9. We're studying of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. And if I wanted to turn, Jared, in the Bible and read about Saul of Tarsus and his conversion, where would I turn? I knew you'd sort of say that. Is there any other place I would turn? 22 and 26. What she said. I'd look at Acts 9, 22 and 26. Juan asked a very interesting question I've been thinking about since he asked the question. We answered it, but I think it's worthy to think about again. Why do we have three accounts of the conversion of Saul, and why do we see some difference in the accounts? In other words, you've got a little bit of information here that you don't have over there, and so forth. And that's a good question. We responded that Luke is the author of the book of Acts, and as Luke is recording the history, we see that in Acts 9. We also then later, after his conversion, 20-something years later, he has been arrested in the city of Jerusalem. He is presenting his case before the Jewish people in Acts 22, and he recounts the events of his conversion. Luke is recording it for us, but it's Paul that is relating the events of his own conversion. And then, of course, we turn to Acts 26, where Paul is making his defense before King Agrippa. And once again, he's relating the events of his conversion. And one of the significant thing is that in Acts 9, Luke is simply giving the history. The Apostle Paul in 22 and 26 is speaking to different audiences. The multitude of the Jews, the populace in Acts 22, as he has been arrested and is at the steps of the, I guess you would call it the guardhouse as such. And then in Acts 26, in more of an official capacity, as he makes his defense before the king. So, King Agrippa. So you've got different audiences in those two instances. You've got different circumstances in those two instances. And you've got different, as it were, speakers in those instances from Acts 9. Luke is recording the events, and these two, Acts 22 and Acts 26, the speaker is, in fact, the Apostle Paul. Luke recording, but the speaker is Paul. So I think that's a great question and one that we need to be aware of. We've suggested in the study of the book of Acts that it would be a wonderful thing if you'd just sit down and read the book, maybe once a month. It won't take you all that long to read the book, but read it frequently. We must know this book. We must know where things are found in this book as well as what is said. In our study, we're talking about the conversion of Saul, and we've looked at this chart at the conclusion of our study last week, and we noted that in Acts chapter 9, in verses 3 through verse 9, as Paul is journeying on his way to Damascus with letters in hand from the Jewish court, that he has requested himself to go and find those who are Christians, those who are of the way, verse 2, that he might bind them and bring them to the city of Jerusalem. And of course, the intent was that they might be persecuted or perhaps even killed, as was the case of Stephen in Acts chapter 7. And Saul held the garments of those who stoned Stephen to death. The words that are in verse 1 of chapter 9, we want to simply underscore once more, Saul yet breathing threatening and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord. Threatening and slaughter. Saul, at this point, is interested in killing people who are Christians, thinking that the thing that he's doing is right. Now, on the road to Damascus, the Lord appeared to him and spoke to him. And we know that as the Lord identified himself with the words, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest. We made the conclusion or tied it together that as Paul is breathing threatening and slaughter against the disciples, later we see that he sought to destroy the church, then how he's treating the disciples is how he's treating the Lord. And we want to underscore that in our thinking. But Jesus identifies himself. And in verse 6 of this text, it says, But arise and enter into the city, and it shall be told thee what thou must
do. Now, we sometimes pause on that word must, and that's a good thing. Paul is not going to go into the city of Damascus where Ananias is going to tell him that his duty and responsibility is to preach to this one and to preach to this one and travel over here, and here's what your agenda is. No. He's going into the city of Damascus where it will be told him what he is compelled to do. This is what you must do. Now, do about what? Forgiveness of sins. That's right. I can't begin to imagine the circumstance in Paul's mind as he is in the city of Damascus for 3 days, did neither eat nor drink, and the reflection upon his sincerity, the reflection upon his own integrity, the reflection upon his desire to serve the Lord, while all the time realizing that his efforts to do so was resulting in persecuting the Lord. And then to stop and ponder that for 3 days. That would be somewhat rattling to your cage, and that's what was Paul. We learned that he didn't either eat nor drink for 3 days. And then Ananias came to him and told him what he must do. In verse 6 of this text, "Arise and go into the city, and it shall be told thee what thou must do. And the men that journeyed with him stood speechless," verse 7, "hearing the voice, but beholding no man. And Saul arose from the earth, and when his eyes were opened, he saw nothing. And they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And he was 3 days without sight and did neither eat nor drink." Can you imagine the misery that's in the heart of this man because of what he's been doing? You see, holding the garments of those who stoned Stephen to death was not just a matter of convenience for those who were carrying out the commandment of the Lord. What he's done has been a crime. Not only a legal crime, but it's sinful. He's committed murder, being a participant in the murder of young Stephen. Yes.
Let's say he was a man of conscience. We don't see him going to these people's houses and killing them in their houses. He was dragging them off to prison,
yeah,
where they could be tried or blasphemy or whatever it was. But again, still guilty of the same thing, but it was not a direct thing. He wasn't going in and slashing their throats because they were Christians.
No, but we sometimes use the expression guilt by association. And here's where we are with Saul. When he's writing concerning the things that he did, he says that he was guilty of murder. And you can turn to the account there in Paul's account to Timothy in verse 13, "Though I was before a blasphemer and a persecutor and injurious, howbeit I obtained mercy because I did it ignorantly in unbelief." In the account that we've alluded to in Acts 26, as he speaks before King Agrippa, there beginning in verse 9, "I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And this I did in Jerusalem. And I both shut up many of the saints in prisons, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I gave my vote against them." What did he do? You see, guilt by association. Here's what he did. He tried his best to make them deny their allegiance to the Lord. And he used the word persecuted them. Now, you can let your mind wander around on what that might have entailed, what you might do to force somebody to say something that they don't believe. And then we see that Saul of Tarsus, later the Apostle Paul, now he becomes subjected to the very same thing. And of all people, he understood it. He understood the why.
And there's been one that strikes that self-exam
in ID. Yeah. Yeah. ID. Paul has an opportunity, or Saul, to examine himself, and in these verses, the Lord ID'd or identified himself. Perhaps I need to use the words. He identified himself. "I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest." Saul has asked the question, "Who art thou, Lord?" Now, as he comes into the city of Damascus, Ananias is the man to teach him. And Randy, would you read for me Acts chapter 9, verses 10 through 16, please?
9, 10 through 16.
Uh-huh.
was a disciple at Damascus called Ananias, and the Lord said to him in a vision, Ananias, and he said, Here I am, Lord. And the Lord said to him, Get up and go to the street called Straight and inquire at the house of Judas for a man from Tarsus named Saul, where he is praying. And he had seen in a vision a man named Ananias come in and lay his hands on him so that he might regain his sight. Ananias answered, Lord, I have heard from many about this man, how much harm he did to your saints at Jerusalem. And here he has authority from the priests to bind all who call on your name. But the Lord said to him, Go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine, to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the sons of Israel. For I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake.
And indeed, he did. But Ananias, he's afraid to go to this fellow. He's heard of the things that he's done. And certainly you would be too. Ananias is a Christian. He's among the saints. And I've heard of the things that he's done among the saints in Jerusalem. By the way, this is the first time the word saint is used to describe those who are Christians. Just a little tidbit there of information. But we know that Ananias goes to this man and tells him what he must do. We'll pick that up in verse 17 and following. But I want to talk just a little bit about what the Lord says to Ananias. What is it that Saul is going to do? What is it that Saul is going to do?
He's going to become an apostle of Christ and preach to the Gentiles.
Yes. The Lord said he's a chosen vessel unto me. The idea of being a chosen vessel. Now, maybe we need to just back up and identify what is a vessel?
A container.
Yeah, exactly. And as the Apostle Paul is writing concerning his role in the deliverance of the gospel of Christ, he says to those in Corinth in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and in verse 7, But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the exceeding greatness of power may be of God and not from ourselves. Paul is referring to himself and the other apostles as vessels. We're containers, as it were. The Lord has entrusted us with this message to make this message known. And Ananias is told concerning Saul, I've selected him. He's going to be one of these earthen vessels that I'm entrusting my word to, and what's he going to do with it? Well, he's going to bear my name before the Gentiles. Now, we know that Paul is referred to as the apostle unto the Gentiles there in Galatians chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, and we see efforts on his part in Ephesians chapter 3, verses 6 through 12, as he's speaking the word to the Gentiles. And that passage, by the way, Ephesians chapter 3, I suppose that sometimes when you read from the Scriptures, there are some passages that really make an impression on you. And this one ought to. In Ephesians chapter 3, Paul says in verse 8, Unto me, who am less than the least of all saints, was this grace given to preach unto the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ. What a powerful text. And it helps us, I think, to see the humility in the mind of Paul. What a privilege to preach this saving message to the Gentiles. Well, Ananias is being told here in our text that that's what Saul of Tarsus is going to do. He's going to be a chosen vessel to preach the gospel among the Gentiles. And to bear my name not only among Gentiles, but also before kings. Now, that's an interesting statement. Juan, how'd you like to stand before the leading dignitary of some particular nation and you're going to try to tell him what you've done to be a Christian?
That would be pretty hard. I mean, two is that his life was in balance when that happened. Two wasn't just the fact that he was sitting there saying, oh, this is why I'm a Christian, but he was sitting there saying, this is why I should.
Well, yeah, and then you add to that the environment. You see, the role of the Roman kings, as it were, such as Agrippa, which we know he stood before Agrippa in Acts 26, was to keep peace. We don't want any kind of uproar going on. Keep peace. We want everything to be good. And now, you know, the Jews have been living here for a long time. They do their thing. They have their civil proceedings and so forth. And Agrippa's job is to just make sure things run smoothly. And here's Paul, formerly Saul of Tarsus, who was a prominent figure in the Jews' religion, who's now left that to become one of these that's referred to as a sect that's the source of all the trouble. And it's Saul now who makes his defense. How'd you like to do that? That'd be challenging. But this is what Ananias is told. He's going to appear before kings. He did before King Agrippa. And he did before Caesar. You remember when he was arrested in Jerusalem? The objective was that eventually he was to go and appear before Caesar through these trials with Felix, Festus, Agrippa, and then he appealed his case from Festus to the king, Caesar. Yes, sir?
You know, the time that he was knocked down off the horse, and he says, "Where art thou, Lord?" And then he tells him, you know, and then he tells him to go to Damascus. You know, can you imagine everything that Saul has thought of, and all that Saul has believed, and still, even those 3 days, he hadn't really think about, this is really who I've been crucifying and killing. But then when Ananias comes to him, he sits down and he explains really the gospel message to him more quickly.
That's right. And of course, this is a difficult thing. I want to try to really hammer this home in our minds. You know, sometimes we leave something that's very comfortable to us. We leave something that everybody perhaps that we know is involved with. And our leaving that really upsets the apple cart. Sometimes in family, sometimes in friends. And we think of Saul of Tarsus as one of the leaders among the Jews as if, well, he didn't have any friends or he didn't have any family. And the reaction of his conversion from those that were close to him, we sometimes don't even give that a thought. But he had friends. He was brought up at the feet of Gamaliel, one of the most prominent Jewish teachers that there was. And then to think he's willing to leave all of that to become a Christian, a part of this sect. Now, when we make such a change in our lives, we want to reflect upon what Paul did. When Paul left, was his life in jeopardy? Yes. You know, there are religions today that if you leave it, your life may very well be in jeopardy.
Exile.
Pardon me?
Exile.
Yes, you may be in exile. That's right. You may be killed, you see. And so the question is, do you have that kind of conviction? Here's what we're looking at concerning Saul of Tarsus. He was told to arise and be baptized, and he did. But then how did he reflect upon his past life? You know, if you're involved, let's say, in the Mormon religion for all of your life, or the Jehovah's Witness religion for all of your life, and you've been brought up that way and as a part of the family religion, you know, everybody in my family's a part of that, and you leave that, you think it's going to be tough for you? Well, yeah.
Well, maybe it's your family, your friends, your religion, your culture, your whole way of life is being abandoned. Everything you know that's comfortable, everything you're used to, your comfort zone, you stepped out of all of that. It's a complete change.
Well, that's right. And look at how Paul then reflects upon that later. Here is 1 Corinthians 15, verses 8 and 9. We'll talk about that in the sermon just a little bit, in a little bit. But what we want to note for our purposes now is he's identifying the appearances of the resurrected Christ. And he says in verse 8, "And last of all, as to a child untimely born, he appeared to me also. For I am the least of the apostles, that I am not meet to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God." Here's what it did. "And the Lord saved me. He appeared to me." Do you see the importance of the conversion, or I should say maybe the leaving of this background religion to become this? You see, when we talk with folks about that, it's a good illustration to use. And, of course, one of the approaches we're making to the book of Acts this time is to try to help us to see how to teach somebody who is not a Christian. Bruce, then James.
You know, even the timing is important. Because, you know, as you know, people see very many religious stuff, and you see people call themselves apostles, but then the timing that Paul became who he was is significant. There's no way that anybody today could be what he is. He's the last.
Well, yes, he said, last of all, the Lord appeared to me. He's not going to appear to you. The last one, last appearance he made was to me as a child untimely born. Now that analogy we're familiar with, a child that comes into the world when they're not expected to arrive. And that's what he said. Now, in reference to that, Ananias is being told, I'm going to show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. And I want to read with you a portion of that from the Galatian letter, chapter 6 and verse 17. If you'd like, you can read 2 Corinthians 11, verses 23 and the whole context way on down. But in Galatians chapter 6, verse 17, Paul writes, henceforth let no man trouble me, for I bear branded on my body the marks of Jesus. You think he had any scars? Yeah. You want to see what made him? You've got a good idea.
In the second Corinthians letter, he gives some very graphic descriptions of what happened to him. The beatings, the scourgings, the shipwreckings, the perils, all of that. He did not live a very stress-free life after becoming a Christian.
Well, that's right. He says, of the Jews, five times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice was I beaten with rods. Once was I stoned. Now, you know where that was, don't you? Where was it?
Lystra.
What chapter?
14.
Yeah, you can turn and read about that. He says, thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day have I been in the deep. You just read this text and you can be impressed when he says, I've got the marks. I have them branded in my body. He knew what it was to leave this to become something else.
Well, Mickey, was looking at all this too about Saul's conversion, what we should all be impressed with too is the power of the evidence. To leave your comfort zone, your family, your friends, how you grew up, your whole way of life, your culture, even just from a civil perspective, let alone a spiritual perspective, there was something about this evidence he was presented with. Of course, seeing the Lord himself is pretty undeniable right there. There was something about that that was undeniable. If you're honest, you can't reject this. You have to respond to it, and that necessitated a complete change. So he was a totally convinced man. That's what this evidence did.
That's right. We're going to talk more about that. He was persuaded by the evidence. And sincerity and integrity and honesty demanded that he submit to it.
Yet also, his shipwreck. He's also human being bitten by the poisonous viper.
Oh yeah, there were several things that happened. Of course, that was evidence, credentials of his apostleship. The miracle of being bitten by snakes that bit an army. Yeah.
Just two observations when you were saying about you might have to leave everything that you knew, and your friends and family are a part of a group, and now you're not. One of the first things my mother said to me when I told her I'd become a Christian was she said, and you bring chickens' necks and drink their blood. I thought, what?
Wow.
I mountains of Appalachia is all that came to her, I guess. Maybe people did that kind of stuff there. It was the strangest thing, and she was so afraid for me.
Yeah.
And then it took me more than 2 years to stop missing the smell of incense. it's hard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of that sort of thing has just kind of become a part of your life for so long. And I want to suggest this to you, or say this to you, when we're talking about a change and family and friends and that sort of thing, that doesn't mean that I can't go home. In some cases it might, but not by your choice. I knew a young lady one time that was involved in a particular denominational religion, and her folks were so adamant when she became a Christian, they said, "Don't come home. You don't have a home." And they meant it. And that's exactly what occurred. When she was baptized into Christ, she didn't have a home to go to. She was the ripe old age of 18. She didn't have a job. She didn't have a house to live in. She had nothing. Some members of the church took her in, gave her a place to live until she was, you know, able to go on her own. And the thing I'm trying to get you to see in this is the element of sacrifice to serve the Lord is real. It can be a whole lot worse in this family than it is this one, or this environment than it is this one, or this group of associates than this. But it's real. And the question is, are we willing to make that kind of commitment? I've said this before, and I'm going to say it probably, Lord willing, many times more. One of two things has to happen. When you hear the truth, you understand it, you know it's so. If you're honest and sincerely mistaken, one of two things got to happen. You're going to stop being honest, or you're going to stop being mistaken. I don't know another way to go with that. You just got to go with that. You stop being honest, or you stop being mistaken. Yeah, you can satisfy yourself with that, and you're really not honest at that point. Yeah, you made yourself comfortable with that. And here's the key. Paul had to learn what it was to be humble in his suffering. And how did he learn that? He suffered for the cause of Christ. I'm going to show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. And indeed he did from that point forward. We read of the persecutions that he endured. Now, the Lord appeared to him on the road to Damascus. Sometimes the issue is brought up about some miracle in my life. Something spectacular, or I've seen the Lord, or I saw an angel, or something such as that, and I knew I was saved at that time. Now, we've talked about a man who, well, we're going to in Acts chapter 10, who saw an angel. What was his name? Cornelius. Well, we've talked about a man who saw an angel in Acts chapter 8. What was his name? Philip. All right, we've got a preacher now. And Cornelius is a student in chapter 10, and an angel appeared to both of them. But was the purpose of the appearing of an angel in either instance to save the individual? Well, no, Philip was already saved. He was among the disciples. And Cornelius, though he was a good man, needed yet to be saved. He needed to hear the words whereby he might be saved. Now, Philip, the appearance of the angel to him, brought him to the eunuch where he could teach him. Flip that just right over. Cornelius, the angel appeared to Cornelius, and he then sent to get the preacher to come so he could teach him and hear words whereby he might be saved. So the purpose of the miracle wasn't to save the individual. What was it that saved the individual? All right, the words of Christ.
The angel was sent to put the teacher and the student together.
Yeah, bring them together. Bring them together. Now, this vision that we see here, we want to note that, yes, Saul saw the Lord. Have to go slow through that. He saw the Lord. But the Lord didn't appear to him to save him. For even so, he said, "What must I do?" And the Lord said, "Go into the city, and it'll be told thee what thou must do." Now, we read that he's miserable. For 3 days, didn't either eat nor drink. And I want to say this so some of you do remember it, and so that's the rest of you will in times to come. If you have an opportunity to talk with somebody who makes the argument that Saul was saved on the road to Damascus, you want to assure folks that he was certainly the most miserable saved man you ever read about in all the Bible. Because he didn't either eat nor drink for 3 days. Another thing that we want to note is, if he was saved on the road to Damascus. He didn't know about it because it ought to have been an occasion of rejoicing. But he's not rejoicing. Another thing, Ananias didn't know about it. Because Ananias told him to arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins. Ananias is telling him what to do to get rid of sin. So Ananias didn't know it had already been done. And certainly the Lord didn't know it. Because who was it told Ananias to go preach to Saul? Well, that'd be the Lord, you see. Now, the evidence is overwhelming that Saul was not saved on the road to Damascus. James and then Bruce.
You contrast that to the Ethiopian eunuch. You sure knew he was saved because he went away with us.
Yes, the Jews in Acts 2 and the host.
If you have become a Christian, you know it. It's not this thing where all of a sudden you're told, oh, guess what you are now.
Yeah.
You know it because you've done what you know the Word says.
Well, that's right. That's right. Bruce?
So he had not heard, but once he heard, he became obedient.
He became obedient. That's right. Saul saw the vision. Now why? He saw the Lord. Why? The Lord said to Ananias, I'm going to make him a chosen vessel. Well, what kind of a vessel was he?
He had to see the resurrected Christ to qualify to be an apostle.
That's right. He was to be an apostle. And that was one of the qualifying factors. Acts chapter 1, when they began to consider who to take the place of Judas Iscariot. We note that when the two men were being considered, the qualification, one of the qualifications was to be an eyewitness of the resurrected Christ. Now, Saul, later, the Apostle Paul, tells us that that's why the Lord appeared to him. See, we don't have to speculate on that. We know from Acts 1 that that was one of the qualifying qualities, but Paul tells us in Acts 26, beginning in verse 16, as he relates the events to King Agrippa, he said, but arise and stand upon thy feet, for to this end have I appeared unto thee, to appoint thee a minister and a witness, both of the things wherein thou hast seen me and of the things wherein I will appear unto thee. Saul, I've appeared to you so you can be a witness of what you've seen and what you've heard. Now, when Saul of Tarsus, as the Apostle Paul, goes to a group of folks and he tells them, I know that Jesus is the Christ, Jesus of Nazareth, he's the Son of God. He lived, he died, he was crucified, buried, raised from the dead. Saul, how you know that? I saw him. Now, how do you refute that? Now, here's the question. How can you be a witness of something that you've neither seen nor heard? Would that qualify in any court in this country?
That's called false testimony.
That's what that's called. That's what that's called. And there are a whole host of people that call themselves witnesses. A particular cult or group of people call themselves witnesses. Have they witnessed the resurrected Christ? No, but Saul had. He had. He saw the resurrected Christ. And therefore he was qualified as an apostle. Now, when you talk with the folks who are involved in the Mormon religion, they'll tell you that they have apostles. Well, have the apostles that the Mormon church has, have they seen the resurrected Christ? Well, no, no. But that was one of the qualifying elements. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and in verse 1, Paul said, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are not ye my work of the Lord or in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, yet at least I am to you. For the seal of mine apostleship are ye in the Lord. What did he say? I saw the Lord. Now, have you seen the Lord? No, you haven't seen. But Saul has. Now, that ought to make what Saul or Paul said about the Lord something you need to listen to. Yeah.
The other thing that makes you an apostle, I mean, the word apostle means one that has been sent. You didn't just see the Lord. The Lord spoke to him and sent it.
Yeah.
Tell him what to go, where to go.
That's right. We're going to talk about that when he went to Arabia and back to Damascus and then to Jerusalem and so forth. So the vision was not saving. We need not expect a miracle. regarding our salvation. So if you're looking and waiting for some miraculous experience to happen to you, then that's just not going to be. Now, a dear friend of mine passed away now, Donna Clinton Henson. We were talking one day about his background. He had been involved in the Baptist church. And he had been taught that the way that you're saved is that you have some kind of a feeling that causes you to go to the mourner's bench. Now, who knows what that is? Who's ever heard of that? The mourner's bench. Okay. I know. Some of you think that's, well, moving right along. You go to the mourner's bench, and what that is, a place up front, up here, where when the calling is extended, that you go up there and you get down on your knees and you pray. And you pray, and you pray, and you pray, and you pray, until, well, they say, you've prayed through. And then you have this experience. You know that the Lord has saved you. You've finally prayed through. Any of you know anybody that has been there, done that? All right, Bruce,
you know, and with that, Nikki, you're not talking about maybe just that day.
No, no.
This may go on
for
months and years.
Yeah.
I want to say it was in the memoirs of Alexander Campbell. So that he just spent so long upon the mourner's bench and nothing happened.
Yeah.
And then he finally started reading in the Bible and realized that it doesn't mention anything about any such a thing. And that's what got him thinking.
Clinton Henson, same thing. Same exact thing. He'd been taught this by his family. He thought this was what was expected, that he'd pray and pray and pray and pray, and finally he'd pray through, and nothing happened. And he started reading his Bible. And he found out that whole thing is, that's not in the Bible. No man in the book of God was ever told to pray through for salvation. Saul was not told that. He was told to arise and be baptized and wash away his sins. And you know what Clinton did? He arose and was baptized and washed away his sins. What is it? Well, you pray through to salvation is the contention. You don't get it?
How do you know when you pray?
Oh, well, you have an experience. Yeah, you just know. You have an experience. And so you know that you've succeeded. And Clinton and Alexander Campbell, as it were, they prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed, and nothing changed. Well, do you really think it would? Not if you read the Bible.
That sounds like a negative mind. You can't pray through without
unbelief. Yeah, something not right about that, huh? Well, the whole teaching was wrong, just not the Bible.
Yeah. Practically speaking, though, you're talking about an emotional experience.
Oh, yes.
People have an emotional experience and they think that's the Holy Spirit coming to them.
Yeah.
Because they've been told that when you have that experience, that's what that is.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's false teaching.
Yeah, and that's always been interesting.
It's not in the scriptures.
Yeah. How our minds. No. How our minds can be so influenced that as far as our feelings are concerned, we actually feel something. We think we do. Because that's how I've trained my thinking.
Songs. Sometimes you hear a really good song that makes you feel fuzzy and good all over.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're talking about. And the point is, we need not expect that. The Bible doesn't teach that. Saul was told something to do, and when he did it, then he can enjoy salvation. When he arose and was baptized, we learn in Acts chapter 9, verse 18, he was told, this is what you must do. Arise and be baptized. Acts 22:16. And Acts 9:18 says he did. That's what he did. Now I make reference to these different chapters. I don't want to mislead you or get you confused. We've noted that we read of his conversion in all three of those chapters. We get bits and pieces and details here that we don't get there, but we know what Ananias said to him by Saul's own testimony. Ananias said, arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins. In Luke's account of the history, he doesn't mention that, but he tells us what Paul did. He arose and was baptized. Now, what do you think he received? His sins were washed away. His sins were washed away. So he was not saved on the road to Damascus. He spent 3 days in the city regretting what he's done because it has been an offense to God. He thought what he was doing was serving God. Now he finds out it's not. Miserable man. And he's praying, but he didn't pray through, did he? It was when he was baptized, his sins were washed away. When he was baptized, his sins were washed away. Now, this is an interesting question. In the American Standard Translation, it says, "Why tarriest thou?" Well, we don't sometimes talk that way. But why are you waiting? Why do you delay? Years ago, I baptized a young lady. She called me about 6 o'clock in the morning. Her name was Scarlett. Starlet. Starlet. And she called me real early. And she says, "I want to be baptized." We had studied with her the night before. And she said, "I didn't sleep a wink last night." I said, "Well, good." She said, "Good?" I said, "Yeah, good. I'm glad you didn't sleep last night." What do you think she was experiencing but the same thing Saul was experiencing? She's miserable. You know why? She's guilty of sin, and she knew it. And she knew what to do. We just discussed it. And now she's been thinking about this all night long. I don't know why she didn't call me before 6. No point being miserable when you can do something about it. But met her at the church building and baptized her. And what a relief it was. Sin washed away. This question, why are you waiting? That's an important question, folks. Sometimes it just needs to be said or asked. When you're studying with somebody and it appears, "Well, I've reached a dead end. You know, I've told them everything that I think to tell them." Well, maybe you need to ask them, "Well, why are you waiting? Why don't you do something about this?" A friend of mine years ago, he went with a gospel preacher friend of his to a Bible study. The preacher told him, he said, "I'm going to baptize this fellow tonight." The guy said, "Oh, no, you don't know that." He said, "Yeah, I do. I'm going to baptize him tonight." So they went through the study, and the gospel preacher asked the fellow, he said, "Why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized. Wash away thy sins." And the fellow arose and was baptized just like Saul. Well, after it was all said and done, this friend of mine said that he was upset by that. And he said to the preacher, "You didn't give him any choice. You forced him to do that." He said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Well, how did you know on the way that you were going to baptize him?" He said, "I knew what he knew. I knew what I'd taught him. I knew what he understood. And it needed to be asked. Why do you tarry?" And sometimes we need to ask that. Now keep in mind, we're trying to learn how to teach somebody the gospel. Sometimes it's just a question that we need to kick out there for somebody to think about. What's wrong with right now? Now, if there's an objection, you'll know about it. "Why tarriest thou?" Well, there may be a reason. If you find somebody walking back, then there's evidently some reason, some hindrance for their lack of response right then. But if there's not a reason, then you expect to baptize them right then. Now, Jane, please. Thanks for waiting.
When you look at the way Saul reacted after he saw the Lord but before he obeyed the gospel, there is, in many people, an emotional response to the truth they've been taught. And we see that, for example, after the eunuch became a Christian, he went away rejoicing. But that's a result of the preaching of the word. Emotion is not the standard by which truth is determined.
True. And very true.
And Nikki, that's where denominationalism gets the wires crossed, and we have to understand that when we teach people that, you know, some people, when they obey the gospel, they may not, inside, they may feel it and understand what they're doing, but they may not outwardly express that like other people do. You may see different physical responses to it.
Very true.
But that's not the standard by which the truth is determined. What the denominational is saying is, well, if I'm getting this sad, sobby, weird feeling inside, then that must be the Holy Spirit miraculously doing something to me, and that's not the case. That's just you understanding what you've been taught. You're coming to terms with the fact that this is true, I've done this, I'm a sinner, and now you're feeling guilty, which means now you need to do what the Word says.
Well, that's right. Truth sometimes determines feelings, but feelings never determine truth. I just made that up. But you can remember that. I think it's correct. Yeah, I just made that up.
The one thing that seems to be missing from all of these accounts, I mean, it's necessarily inferred, but you know, when he says, "Why do you wait to get up and baptize?" He must have been talking about baptism before that moment.
Oh yes.
And the only place that I can see in Acts 9, where it says in verse 19, after he took food and was strengthened. For several days he was with the disciples who were in Damascus. That must be where he was taught the gospel. You know what I mean?
No.
What I mean is, Ananias didn't come saying, you know, lay your hands on, now you can see, now go get baptized. He hadn't been taught about baptism first.
Well, yes. Yes.
But
yes.
None of the accounts.
No. No, it was in the experience that Ananias and Saul had where the teaching took place. I believe that's true. Yeah, I believe that's true. It's implied.
It's implied.
Yeah,
we don't know.
It's not stated. But we come to the point where the question is asked, and then we see the response.
But he was taught first.
He was taught. That's the pattern in every instance. Now, who did what teaching and at what point on the timeline? We don't know that. That's not revealed to us. It may very well be that Saul has been exposed to this teaching in times gone by. We don't know that. But we know that it was Ananias who came to him and taught him this. And Saul rose and was baptized. Now, there's some elements in this that we want to note. Let's just suppose that somebody came to you and they said to you, "I have seen the resurrected Christ." Would you say, "What a wonderful thing. Surely you were saved." No. Now, Ananias didn't say that. And of all opportunities to say that, he had that opportunity, but he didn't say that. He said, "Arise and be baptized." Notice that when the Lord appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus, Saul said, "Lord, what must I do?" And the Lord didn't preach peace to him because he's miserable. The Lord didn't tell him, you know, "You've been wrong, but now you got it right, so go away in peace." No. He's miserable. There's something he needs to do. He needs to reflect upon what he's done. The preacher is sent to him and taught him what to do. And when he was baptized, now what's his circumstance in life? He can join with the disciples and have occasion of happiness. Okay? Now, why was Saul converted to Christ?
We'll never know.
Yes, we will. Lord willing. Okay. We'll start with that, I guess, next time. If you do not have your questions done, be sure that you get them done on Acts chapter 9. If you don't have a copy of the questions, they're on the website. Right?
What?
Acts 9 questions are on the website.
Oh, yeah, all the questions.
And they're also on the front pew up here, if you would like to have them.